We are now officially the diabetic capital of the world. We are the cardiovascular capital of the world. We have the most number of people with depression. We are quickly becoming the cancer capital of the world. And this list will go on and on and on.
Marcus René.
Dr. Marcus Rani.
Worked with everybody from astronauts to people in the Air Force.
Who is the founder and CEO of Human Edge.
Around human longevity.
Pushing human performance.
This is a big worry. Because it's not just one condition, it is a variety of conditions. The stress which affects us in our day-to-day lives is not that good physiological evolutionary stress. It's the chronic distress. It's the stress which is driven by cortisol, not by adrenaline. Everything from psychedelic mushrooms to cold showers are being propagated, sometimes by people who may not have a full understanding of the science. And so people are naturally confused. They go to Google for their doctor, they go to WhatsApp for their medical university, etc. Or they go to Facebook. And that scares me. Because I blew the candles out and I thought, I'm content. Because I remembered. Sorry. I remembered where I was 3 years ago. Yeah.
Studies have revealed that the average onset age of first chronic disease is happening at a younger and younger age group. What if we aren't living for longer, but dying for longer? My guest, Dr. Marcus René, a biohacker, best-selling author, and public health commentator, talks about this as well as how to measure your health and analyze longevity. How do you know if supplements and fasting are for you? And 5 hacks you need to know to live a better life. Let's go!
In one of your previous interviews, you mentioned that people are not living longer.
Yeah.
People are dying for longer.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
McKinsey most recently published a report where they were looking at life expectancy changes and growth principally since 1960 to just before the pandemic in 2029. And what they found that globally, the average life expectancy has increased by 19 years. So we are living 19 years longer than we were on average in 1960. However, over half of that life is now lived in either poor or moderate health. So we're living longer number of years, but the quality of those lives, the quality of those years has actually reduced. And if we delve a little deeper, the average onset of first chronic disease is now happening at a younger and younger age group. Right? I've got patients who I see who are in their mid-20s, who already have fatty liver disease, diabetes, PCOS, hypertension, etc. Something that we wouldn't even have dreamed of a few decades ago. So this idea that we're chasing lifespan, which a lot of the medical community has rightfully tried to dedicate so much energy, efforts, and money towards over the last many decades, is now leading to a situation because of the systemic changes that we are going through as a species, environmental toxicity, stress challenges, excessive calorific intake, poor sleep conditions, sedentary lives, et cetera, where yes, you may be living more number of years, but truthfully, the quality and the health coefficient of that is getting less and less.
Wow, that is really alarming.
It is. It is something really scary.
Mm. Yeah. And out of the studies or trends in terms of health that are there available, which ones worries the most?
I think they're all pretty scary. And if I look at the country where I live, which is in India, India, as of I think 2 or 3 months ago, became the most populous country in the world. Right? We officially overtook China now with 1.4 billion people. And yes, we also have the new accolade of being the 5th largest economy in the world, overtaking the UK, and recently holding the G20. So there's a lot of attention and energy focused on India. But if you look at the health quality of what's going on, we are now officially the diabetic capital of the world. We are the cardiovascular capital of the world. We have the most number of people with depression. We are quickly becoming the cancer capital of the world. And this list will go on and on and on. And this is a big worry because it's not just one condition. It is a variety of conditions. But I think, and perhaps as we go through this conversation, we'll discover that if you really distill it down to the individual components, all of these things are connected because there's a lot of metabolic dysfunction which is translating itself into some of these conditions. The causative agents are the stuff that we just spoke about, which is around environment and stress and poor sleep and calorific excess and sedentary lives, et cetera, et cetera. So they may seem like these are lots of different problems, but I think with a more systems of view, they actually come together and converge into two or three big challenges, which if we can rectify, they're not easy to rectify, but if we can rectify involving different stakeholders, then we'll start to see effects across all of these things play out.
Mm. And what is the behavior that people are having that is contributing the most for that?
I think our definition of success is pulling us in a direction which is at tension at who we are biologically. We have a definition which is loosely based around materialistic gain and busyness. And when you really think about it, and I've fortunately, so I had a milestone birthday recently, and I spent time in Ladakh, which is, you know, my spiritual home in India. And one of the nice things I like to do, especially when I travel to the mountains, is spend time in small villages and remote communities and just talk to people and how they see the world and their definition of what a good life is so at odds at what we think and we try and practice. And that scares me. As a young father, that really scares me. It scares me for my own life and it scares me for what the world that my children are going to inherit and inhabit. And I hope that... I think our species does well at crises. The pandemic taught us that. I think a crisis is happening. We're seeing it with metabolic disease, with chronic disease, with stress levels, with all the stuff that we'll talk about. And I hope that through this crisis, we discover that there is another version of success that we can really build. It's not going to be easy because we have institutional baggage and legacy. But we can get there. And that's where longevity really is. Mm-hmm.
And for me, I think what gives me hope, I think the pandemic brought people to ask deeper questions about their life. And I think that was very, 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 very important.
Yeah.
For me today, HRV, it's the most important metric that I'm measuring. And you're right.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel like, oh, I'm not stressed. Mm. But it is showing a lower HRV,
right,
which means there's an underlying stress
absolutely,
there,
absolutely,
which I'm not aware.
Yeah.
So I understand like the connection between this and also the chronic disease.
Okay. Yeah.
So you've been working with longevity.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what is longevity from the perspective of human health?
Yeah.
And why is it becoming so popular today?
So I regard longevity as making health an asset again. And I'm fascinated with this idea of living healthier ever after, right? I'm not an individual who strives personally or for the folks that I work with to try and achieve immortality, right? That's not the goal at all. I don't even try to say, okay, we'll do 200, 250. There are lots of longevity folks that talk about these sorts of numbers. But when I look at longevity, it's about how can I and we live a healthier life, which is enjoyable, which is sustainable, and which we have the energy and vitality that we used to have as in our youth, but we can continue it for many, many years thereafter. Right? So that's sort of my definition of it. As a physician, it's become very frustrating because the entire system of healthcare is sick care. And it needed to be that way, because if you look at the progression of medicine, especially after the great wars of the early 20th century, we moved from acute disease, infectious-related deaths, where the advent and invention of antimicrobials, antibiotics, anti-infectious agents, we started to discover a lot better surgical techniques for wound management and anesthesia and pain management, etc. So as a species, we naturally saw our lifespan increase because we were not dying of diseases of childhood and maternal deaths and infectious diseases. And we started then to accumulate diseases of excess, which is the chronic disease status, diabetes, metabolic dysfunction, hypertension, cancer, etc. So we shifted from reactive to preventative, right? What we're now saying is that let's take it a step further. Let's go from preventative to optimization, where it's not just about preventing the disease anymore or not doing certain bad habits. It's looking at the good habits and how can we improve upon it in a scientific framework, which is relevant for you, which is differently relevant for me. Again, we live in a world right now where content, and part of this content is going to be on social media, where everything from psychedelic mushrooms to cold showers are being propagated, sometimes by people who may not have a full understanding of the science. And so people are naturally confused. They go to Google for their doctor, they go to WhatsApp for their medical university, etc., or they go to Facebook. And what I'm most passionate about is how can we understand the science, make it relevant to the individual, personalize it for them based on their data, their objective, their journey, and then support them through that so that health can become their asset and they can live healthier ever after. So that's sort of my lens as a physician around longevity.
Mm-hmm. So you work a lot on prevention, right? So there's things that we can do as individual so that can prevent us.
Prevent and optimize.
And optimize.
Take it one step further.
And so you mentioned there's a lot going on. For people who are wanting to go in this journey of improving their health, what do you see as their main challenge?
So I've got a very simple brain, so I like to think of structures as very simple structures. And I think that actually when you distill it down, there are five areas of life that we should be focusing on to start to make changes and improvements. And they don't involve a medical practitioner. I think this is also perhaps part of the problem. We as individual patients have abdicated responsibility of our health to the profession, which is necessary in certain instances, but the reality of power is much more in your control than your doctor's control, right? When we look at the determinants of longevity and you compare the genomic contributions, so the DNA that you got from your parents and your grandparents, versus the epigenetic contribution, which is how that DNA transcribes and manifests itself versus your experiences and your lifestyle, the second has a almost 80% contribution determinant versus the first. There are certain conditions, such as certain types of cancers where you may carry, or certain neurodegenerative disorders where you may carry a particular gene, which makes you more at risk of that particular condition. Otherwise, for most of the lifestyle conditions we see today, they're either polymodal, so they involve many, many different genetic components, and they are influenced so much by your lifestyle choices, your behaviors, and the people you spend your time with, which are therefore determining how successful you are going to be at living to that 90, 100 and having a healthier version of yourself. So that's an important message for people to understand, that you as the individual have much more control and autonomy over your direction. You're the pilot. The doctor can merely give you a navigational map, but you're the pilot for the journey you need to go on. So if you think about the framework, I have these five areas that I consider to be important from longevity perspective. The first is sleep. I always start with sleep. But the realization for sleep as a powerhouse for regeneration, not downtime, but uptime, that's where the body is healing itself and really becoming a better version of itself, physically, mentally, and emotionally. So sleep is the first piece or the first pillar in that framework. The second is how you fuel the body, not diet. Diet should be thrown out the window. But we're a machine. Biology has given us this machine. Nature has given us this machine. So like any other machine, you need to fuel it in the right way. What are the macronutrients? What are the micronutrients? What is the health of your microbiome? What is the hydration status? What are the toxins that you're absorbing? All of these things which will affect the machinery of this machine that we have. The third is movement. Again, I purposely don't like using the word exercise because people can get averse to it. But your machine is made to move. And you should move aerobically. You should move anaerobically. You should strength train. You need flexibility, you need coordination, you need balance. There's so many forms of movement that all of us can truly integrate into our day-to-day lives. The fourth is the environment, and that's not just the places, but it's the people, the places, and the technologies, because all of this influences our biosphere in the same way that we influence it. And the last is our mental mood and emotional self as well. And I purposely go around in this order and structure because I remind people that you may very well, let's take an example of someone who wants to run a half marathon and they come to say, okay, doc, I'm training for this run and I've got this exercise plan, etc. But I remind them that that's great, but we need to first fix your nutrition because if you're not fueling right, you're not going to be able to move correctly. And even before that, I need to first optimize your recovery. Because if your body is not healing itself during this training, you're not going to be able to progressively grow and improve yourself. Or someone who's got acute stress and anxiety and they want to acutely go to see a mental health counselor. Well, if you haven't fixed the other mechanistic aspects of this, if you're not sleeping well, all of us know if we don't sleep nicely, we wake up grouchy and agitated and stressed and we crave sugary, salty, fatty foods. That's a biological response. We don't move as much because we're lethargic and tired. So all of these things are interconnected, but they go around in a particular sequence. And truthfully, it doesn't require expensive medication. It doesn't require fancy equipment, but it's in the control of the individual. But that's sort of the framework for longevity.
So they are all interconnected.
Yeah.
But what I like is like there's an order, right? As you said, like the first one is sleep.
That's right.
What is interesting is 4 years back, my boss was also measuring a lot of things on his health.
Yeah.
And I started also measuring.
Yeah.
My sleep, I got shocked. I thought I was okay in terms of sleep.
Yeah.
My quality of sleep was 62%.
Wow.
And in the last 4 years, I've been working as a priority on that.
Yeah.
And today I'm at 80%. Mm. The impact that only that had in my life is huge.
Yeah.
So let's start with sleep.
Yeah.
What are like the actionable steps that people can do in order to improve their sleep?
Yeah. So I think the first understanding for people to appreciate is all sleep is not equal. Right. The first is how much do we need? We need between 7 to 9 hours, some sort of variation of that, preferably at night, because that's when the body's circadian rhythm is most at rest. And there's a number of physiological processes which are aligned towards that. But when you're asleep, our brain cycles itself into 90-minute chunks and cycles. And so the different phases of sleep are continuously oscillating themselves. And so we really have two main or really important aspects in that. One is deep sleep, deep rest, which is where our physical body heals and repairs itself. And the second is REM, which is rapid eye movement, which is where your eyes sort of dart back and forth, which is where a lot of the cognitive mental benefits are being accrued. But what's really interesting, if you study the oscillation of these different phases over the course of the night, is that evolutionarily, we have prioritized deep sleep first before the second. And it makes sense, right? If you think about the fact that we needed to outrun the tiger or outpace the deer first before we can think about building a complex piece of machinery, the body naturally wanted to prioritize healing of muscle, healing of bone, healing of cardiovascular system, etc. So in the first two-thirds of the night, as you oscillate through these 90-minute cycles, your body is naturally preferring to spend more time in deep sleep, which is really good. But in the last third of the night, it switches and it almost goes the other way completely, where it's naturally preferring REM, which is why typically most of us wake up feeling like we've just had a dream, because we have. We've had many dreams, but we're just remembering the very, very last one. And the reason why understanding this distinction is so important is because if you're only getting 4-5 hours of sleep, you're not going to have enough time spent where REM is the significant contribution. And so cognitive capabilities, focus, decision-making, professional development, empathy, gratitude, all the stuff that makes us who we are as human beings are not having an opportunity to replenish themselves. The hippocampus, which is the part of the brain responsible for memory and growth, actually volumetrically expands significantly when you get 7 to 8 hours of sleep over a period of time. And we see the same benefits actually with certain forms of meditation as well, which is really interesting. So that's important for people to appreciate. And especially people who are, let's say, from the creative industries or the professional services industries, if they kid themselves that they can do with only 4 or 5 hours a night, I guarantee you, I can show you your data using simple devices to disprove that hypothesis and show you the consequences of that. So it's a very powerful tool. So that's the first thing around sleep. The second is that sleep is a journey of three equal parts, right? So you have the time before you put your head on the pillow, you have the time whilst your head is on the pillow, and you have the time after you immediately wake up. And each of these components are really important for how well rested and energetic we feel for the rest of the day. So typically about 120 minutes, 2 hours before you go to bed, there is a wind down process that the body needs to have. Anyone listening or watching this who've got young kids or had young kids will appreciate the importance of a bedtime routine, right? I've got two small ones, and naturally bath time, brush your teeth, dinner, read a book, lights out. You know, there's a whole process of getting them finally to fall asleep. And we think as adults that we don't need that anymore, but that's not the case at all. Our brain and our physiology still requires it. So we need to optimize that last 120 minutes around the routine to ensure we're doing all the various biohacks and lifestyle recommendations to gradually, almost like landing the airplane, like gradually bring yourself in to sleep. And then what you do whilst you're sleeping. And then finally, that 15, 20, 30 minutes after you wake up. Again, a consequence of the mobile technology is that it's the first thing, last thing we see at night and the first thing we wake up to in the morning. And immediately it's bombarding the amygdala, driving cortisol. Someone else is dictating your intention and your purpose and priority for the day. And it completely sets you off on another tangent. So this is how the sleep journey should be broken down into.
Actually, for me, something that had a big impact on REM was meditation.
Okay.
It's super interesting. I could measure the the impact of doing meditation on increasing REM.
And when were you meditating? What time of day?
Always, I was doing in the night, but then I understood that in the morning works better for me.
Right.
And now I've been on an incredible journey. I've been now meditating. It changed my life. I've been now meditating for 700 days in a row without missing one day.
Wow.
1 hour a day.
Wow.
And that has changed my life. It was I've been doing many, many things to improve my health and my performance.
Yeah.
But that one really changed a lot in my life.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm glad you bring that up, because as I was alluding to, this very interesting study which was done looking at the volume of the hippocampus.
Yeah.
And the hippocampus is a really important part of the brain, because as we age, particularly the onset of certain neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's and disorders affecting memory loss, the hippocampus begins to shrink. And what we found is that not only is sleep volumetrically advantageous to the hippocampus, but even these forms of exercises around meditation, breath work, and intentional activities can also have the same effect. And I think it's fascinating. I think there's a whole area of science which is not as well studied around energy and harmonics and the effects of energy on different body systems. And this is one of those things where you're putting your brain into an altered energetic state, which we can measure through different wave formations. And somehow that is leading to disproportionate advantages in different parts of the brain. I'm really excited by that body of work to come out, hopefully over the next few years. Yeah.
So whoever is listening, like, we understood, like, that it's our health is more in our control than we think.
Yeah.
So, for example, if someone comes to you, what are the three things that people can do in order to improve their longevity, their performance, and even their life?
Yeah. We'll start with the sleep aspect first. Yes. We always do. And the way I try to make it simplified for people is to talk about the methodology of biohacking. Not from a hacking negative sense, but a hacking simplification sense. In the sense that you have an operating system, physiological and psychological. And how can we hack that to optimize it in a better way? So the simple act of having the temperature of your bedroom controlled to 17 to 18 degrees Celsius or 60 to 64 degrees Fahrenheit allows your body into a deeper restorative state in deep sleep. So temperature control. And then similar to a lot of our viewers may have read Atomic Habits by James Clear. He talks about habit stacking. So we've got the biohack of temperature control. Let's do a biostack now. So you have a warm bath, shower or sauna 20 minutes before going into that chilled room. And suddenly what happens is in that warm environment, there's a vasodilation of your blood vessels. There's a secretion of nitric oxide, a reduction in blood pressure. You're going into a relaxed state. And then you go into a cold environment. You're now compounding the effects of the benefit. So both of those, one on the thermal contrast, can have a much greater effect. Another simple activation is around magnesium. There are many magnesium salts, but generally biglycinate and threonate, 400 milligrams taken at 8 p.m. Magnesium is a salt which we are all deficient in because the soil doesn't have it anymore. So it's not getting its way into the plant or the food chain. So magnesium has many different effects. It can mitigate and alleviate stress and bring down mood. It puts you in a more relaxative state, helps with sleep. It can be quite beneficial for people suffering from irritable bowel and digestive disturbances, etc. So magnesium at 8 p.m. is another mechanism. So these are just simple, small changes that people can make in their day-to-day lives to try and optimize their routine towards an advantage for them. And in the same way as sleep, we might look at changes around their nutritional plan or changes around their movement plans, etc. So one of the things that I am greatly in favor of is time-restricted eating, otherwise known as intermittent fasting. Right? Now, this has become very popular of late. And it's not a one-size-fits-all, unfortunately. So it's a little bit more nuanced in trying to understand what's the objective and the goal, and therefore how long and which part of the day do we really want to add this in. But I think IF, or time-restricted eating, has got a big benefit. And I've seen in my own self, in my own life as well, a big benefit and role to play from a fasting perspective. So these are sort of the small tweaks that people can start to make. Yeah.
And give it one more. I mean, this is so good. Give us one more.
I think my go-to is vagus breathing. Mm. So vagus breathing, for people who may not be familiar. So the fight and flight, all our viewers would probably be aware of, which is a sympathetic overdrive. And then the autonomic nervous system, like a lot of other systems, has a yin and yang. So the parasympathetic nervous system is rest and digest. It slows the body down. And this nerve, which is cranial nerve 10, innervates the heart, the lungs, the gut, and a lot of other bodily systems. And its activity is to reduce the activation of that. What's fascinating about this is that it is activated by the physical act of breathing. So box breathing is a technique where you breathe in for four counts, you hold for four counts, you breathe out for four counts, you hold for four counts. So you literally go down in a box. You can do it 4-4-4, you can do it 5-5-5, or maximum 6-6-6-6. and repeat it. And this activation reduces your heart rate, reduces your respiratory rate, brings down the acute stress response, and puts you in a much calmer, mindful, centered state. So if I'm in a stress situation, or if I'm coming out or going into this, I use this, literally takes 64 seconds, right, to just center myself and ground myself so that I can deal with the challenge.
While you were speaking, I was thinking, like, all these, they are small things that are available to us. You know, as I said, intermittent fasting, breathing, like set the temperature of the room. They are small, but as I said, like you start doing all these things, they start compounding and they have a huge impact on us. Wow, this is so cool. I'm also passionate by this topic.
Yes.
And something that helped me a lot was when I started measuring.
Right.
For me, the number one now, it's HRV.
Yeah.
Second has been the quality of my sleep. and third is the time doing meditation.
Right.
Those are the three that I'm measuring, but I'm also measuring more.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you brought the topic of intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of confusion. But there's also another topic where there's, I find there's so much information, there's so much misunderstanding.
Right.
And I would like you to show us the light about supplements.
Okay. it's a contentious issue, and I completely understand people's concerns. And truthfully, I would love to live in a world where I don't need to take any supplements, but that's not the reality. On my podcast a couple of years ago, I had two incredible professors, Bonnie Kaplan and Julia Ruckledge, whom have written a book together called Better Brain, which is nutrition above the neck. And their entire thesis was looking at micronutrient supplementation and its role in psychological and brain health. And as they studied the quality of food over the last 3.5-4 decades, principally from North America, they found that not only are we living an ultra-processed life in terms of consumptive patterns, but more dangerously, even those who are eating fruit and vegetables and real foods, because of the agricultural techniques and the quality of the soil, we do not have the micronutrients which are making their way into the food chain. I mean, principally today we're using NPK, nitrogen, phosphate, and potassium, and the soil quality has diminished so significantly that they found there's a 92% reduction in micronutrients since 1970 to today. So it's not that I'm trying to promote people to take pills and supplements for the sake of it. I would love to live in a world where we didn't. But unfortunately, the systems are not geared to us having those micronutrients, which are critical for every one of the metabolic reactions that needs to happen in the body. Vitamins, cofactors, and minerals. And there are 31 essential micronutrients, and there are 9 essential amino acids that we can't make endogenously, and we have to get from the external world. And we're seeing such low levels in society. So there are certain supplements which are really important, and to share those with you, given the clinical experiences and the audience, particularly people from South Asia, we're very, very deficient in vitamin B and D, right? And D, specifically the D3 compound, which is best taken with K2 as an adjunct for the absorption. Vitamin B12 is something which a lot of people are deficient in. So these are two things that anyone I test will most likely be on the negative side of the equation. Omega-3 is really important. Omega-3 principally comes from fish-based products. Again, our diets are slowly shifting towards red meat and white meat as we're getting more prosperous. And the quality of seafood is getting worse, especially with mercury and fishing techniques, farm-based fishing techniques, etc. So omega-3 is really important because it keeps the neuronal health of our brain and our spinal cord healthy, because it wraps the sheet with fatty cholesterol, which is made of omega-3, which is very important. Magnesium we spoke about already. Very important for sleep recovery, emotional health, etc. So these are some of the micronutrients which are important. Now, my list is a little longer than that from a longevity perspective, and people sometimes ask about it. So I published a list on LinkedIn recently. But I I think the message is people shouldn't be anxious or fearful of it. Find a good brand. Do your research to understand the bioavailability and the concentration of what's in the supplement. And particularly for these four or five key things, and then amino acids as well, make sure you're getting the right supplementation, because your health will drastically improve towards a favorable outcome.
Now I understand. So it comes from the soil, from the food that we are getting. We are not getting enough of what we should have.
Exactly.
So what you say, we should look at at least some of them that will serve as a complement to our food.
Yeah.
Really, really good. With biohacking, it's very popular. There's so many products and services out there.
Yeah.
Can you help us
how
to navigate and to take the best decisions for us?
N equals one. Mm. What that means is that each of us is our own experiment and we need to understand what works for us and what doesn't work for us. So do your research, follow your influencer, hear what she or he has to say, try it. But when you try it, think about the metric that you want to measure to try and observe change. And if it's working for you and not having a harm, fantastic. If it's not working for you, ditch it and try something else. But just because something works for one person doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work for another person. I think this is something really important for everyone to appreciate. And the second would be that it doesn't need to be complicated. There are many, many very interesting supplements, very interesting products, very interesting solutions. And I, as a geek, love to play around and try all these things. And I think you're probably in the same category.
Yes.
And it's great, but it doesn't mean that everyone needs to be having cold water immersion or red light therapy or theta waves at night or using those headbands and those types of things. There are simpler techniques that we can do, but it'll still move the needle forward for us and it'll lead us to a healthier, better life.
I love that. Marcos, there's something that I know if we don't discuss today, you will not forgive me till the rest of my life.
Okay.
Do you know what it is?
I think it starts with an M.
Yes.
And it's on me.
Mitochondria.
Yes.
Is something that you've been passionate about.
Yeah. Obsessed. Yeah.
And it looks like it's something with a lot of potential for the future health of our planet.
Yeah.
Right? Can you tell us more about what it is and what's the potential?
So let me take you back in time, 2 billion years ago, roughly, not to the day. There were two little organisms that found themselves somewhere in some great ocean, and the bigger one consumed the smaller one, as happens probably trillions of times every single day. But what was interesting about this one interaction is that when the bigger one consumed the little one, it did not destroy and completely obliterate the little one. There was a harmony that was created. The little one appreciated the bigger one because it gave it protection. And the big one appreciated the little one because it started to produce something which helped the other one grow. And this was the beginnings of mitochondria. It was the encapsulation of a pre-bacteria-like life form. And it's only happened once that we know of in the animal kingdom. It's happened, I think, twice or thrice in the plant kingdom, and they have their own version through sort of chloroplasts. But what's really interesting about mitochondria is that it creates energy. It consumes fuel, and it creates energy in the form of ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is critical for every cellular process in the body. So that's what mitochondria is. It's there in every cell in your body except the red cell, which is sort of evolved to be efficient at carrying oxygen. But otherwise, every cell in the body has mitochondria. So whether you're a cell in the pancreas whose job it is to secrete insulin, you need mitochondria, because if you don't have the energy, you can't do your job. If you're a cell in the heart who has to pump for the blood to flow, you need mitochondria, because if you don't have energy, you're not going to be able to do your job. So I first discovered mitochondria, believe it or not, in the textbooks when I was still in sort of early stages of med school. And I was just fascinated by how this little organic thing created something of such value that this entire organism, like ourselves and all the other organisms in terms of the animal kingdom, get such a great benefit from it. But where the catalyst truly came about in terms of my obsession for it was in late 2007. I was leading a medical research team on Mount Everest, and we were looking at the effects of low oxygen on the human body. And this was an important subject to understand, because patients every day, and we've just come through a pandemic, and a lot of people have experienced this sort of low oxygen saturation and how ill they felt. How is it that some people did better than others? What was happening in individuals at altitude where oxygen is low, which allowed them to adapt themselves? And it's true, your respiratory rate goes up, your heart rate beats faster, your red blood cells improve, increase, etc., etc. But the underlying difference alluded to was there is something which was changing at the mitochondrial level that allowed it to burn oxygen more lean. And there was a contribution from that. And that's when I got hooked, which is what, about almost 15, 20 years ago. So over the course of that time period, we are seeing the effects of understanding mitochondria more important in the performance world. So the athletes that I work with and cricketers, etc., because you naturally want to produce more energy to perform better on the field. But really interestingly, in the longevity world, in the last decade or so, there has now been shown that mitochondrial dysfunction is one of the 9 key hallmarks of aging. So as the mitochondria is no longer able to do its job, the cells of that system can no longer function, as disparate as neurodegenerative disorders, cancer, metabolic dysfunction, and cardiovascular disease, like these 4 big killers that we have. So if we are able to, over the next few decades, better understand to diagnose, to intervene, and to provide therapies at the mitochondrial level, I believe that we will not only see benefits in the performance sector, which we're already beginning to see now, but we will begin to see changes in onset and progression of chronic disease. So that's why I get so excited by this topic, and why, it's obsessive for me.
Wow, thank you for breaking that down into a simple way that we can understand. And I can see the potential and why you are so not excited, but obsessed with it.
So obsessed that at med school for one Halloween, I made a costume of Captain Mitochondria. And my wife cringes when she sees that photograph. But I thought I was the coolest. I thought I was the coolest guy at the party.
I'm sure you were. At least you were feeling like the coolest guy.
Yeah, that's the passion.
Very good. Now, by curiosity, what drove you to work with longevity?
I think there's been this arc that I was sharing with you around sort of the career progression of starting early on my early part of the career, which is very performance focused, pre-medicine, ex-serviceman with the Royal Air Force, studying about mitochondria, spending time in extreme environments, really falling in love with the human edge, right? Human edge in extreme conditions. Then going on to medicine, which is a very sick care paradigm and institution, where I began to become disenfranchised with the focus of our energies and trying to create a vehicle to connect the dots back. But it was only personally through the course of the pandemic, wherein in the early days of the pandemic, I, like many other clinicians, became a volunteer working at the front line, and I was doing slum work in the city where I live, which is in Mumbai. And about 3 or 4 months into that effort, I contracted the original strain of the virus. And this was the days before we had any of the monoclonals or any of the fancy therapies. So I was on steroids. I was put on a lot of anti-infective agents and antimicrobial agents. But I had unfortunately developed a neurological consequence, which is where I lost a lot of strength and power in my lower limbs. And I had to go through a process of rehabilitation to get myself back. And I remember, and in fact, the moment is very poignant. You asked this, Carlos, because it was just a few days ago when I was blowing my birthday cake in Ladakh, right? And I was remembering 3 years ago, my mom had baked up cake and she brought it over. And I was just coming out of COVID at that time. And I was thinking, now, what do I wish and what do I blow? Because I was in a very low state. And I told myself, and this is perhaps a mental reframing technique, which is that how often does a runner get to learn how to run again? Right? Because I've always associated my personality with being very physically active.
So good.
And
I love that.
That was my vehicle to biohack and start to put into practice those learnings that I had. And as I went through that, I discovered that if I can do this for self, now it's an opportunity and a responsibility to bring this message for others. So that's part of the work, what we do at Human Edge, is this idea that lifestyle can transform lives, that health can be an asset once again. And the poignancy of this moment was that literally, 10 days ago to the day, as I was sitting in the dark and this time blowing out my birthday cake, having just run the highest marathon in the world in a time I was really proud of. And my wife made the cake and she brought it. She put the cake in front of me and everyone was singing. And I didn't have to wish for anything because I blew the candles out and I thought, I'm content because I remembered. Sorry. I remembered where I was 3 years ago. Yeah.
Wow. That's a very, very powerful story. And how now you translate that you are impacting. I saw that that you impacted already like 55,000 people with your work.
Yeah.
Really, really, really interesting. What is your one message that you would love people to get from this conversation?
Okay. In these conversations, everyone asks me sort of about my past and the journey and what I do. And I never get asked the question, Marcus, if not this, what else would you be doing as a career? And for me, the answer is a simple one. I would be an astronaut. And it's not too late. I hope to be an astronaut one day.
Yeah. Why?
I love space. I'm a big Star Trek fan. I absolutely love Star Trek. And I just love the idea of creating a species which is interplanetary and transgressing above national political boundaries into remembering who we are as a species around exploration, about solving the big challenges in life. And I think we're living through a very interesting phase in that journey. In the next decade, I'm pretty confident we're going to have a permanent presence on the moon. Probably 3 or 4 permanent space stations and have our first rocket en route to our closest planetary neighbor. And I often joke with my wife that if I ever decide to do another startup, firstly, remind me why I shouldn't do it. But secondly, it will be to do with space. So yeah, that's something which I'm still very excited about. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
Great. Marcus, I think today there's a lot going on in the world.
Yeah.
And I think something that I feel that we all need to pay more attention is to our health, to our habits, to our lifestyle, which can work as a prevention to many things in the future. I think you're doing a fantastic work. Thank you for coming and good luck.
Thank you.
With your work.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.